Okay, thanks everyone. And welcome to this webinar. So we are very happy and even proud to have Jerry here with us. He's one of the really central figures in the learning sciences and especially in computer-supported collaborative learning. Jerry studied philosophy actually in a couple of places, including Heidelberg and Frankfurt. In times where these were the, well, let's say the hottest places in Germany to study philosophy, I would say. He was, well, among his professors were people, were students of Adorno and Habermas. Later on, he made a PhD at Northwestern University in also in philosophy, and worked for some time at the University of Colorado. Later on, he switched the focus a bit and went to computer science. He made a master's in science and PhD in addition in computer science. He was a student of Gerhard Fischer and Mike Eisenberg and others, at least they were in his committee. He did research in Colorado, in Boulder, but also in Europe, where he was involved in a project that is still being discussed, ITCO, together with the GMD and Fraunhofer Institute. He was also involved in work on the BSCW, which was the first collaborative work system, so online collaborative work system that I got familiar with. Then he went to Drexel University, and there he developed and worked a lot on the virtual math project, which is still discussed a lot in the community. And in that context, he also developed the main concept that we will be discussing today, that of group cognition. And I think it is really a special perspective also in the learning sciences, because it is really based to a large extent directly on philosophical work. Jerry, we are very much looking forward to your presentation, to your talk, to discuss this with you. I would like to mention that Jerry is investing a lot of time currently, and a lot of time, and he did a lot of successful work in structuring the field as the editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Computer-Supported Collaborative Learning. And I hope we will have the opportunity to discuss and to ask questions about this important learning sciences journal as well. So Jerry, the floor is yours. Maybe for those who came late, I posted a link to Jerry's slides. I do it again. Here it is. So if you quickly download the slides from there and open it, I think Jerry will refer from time to time to these slides and also to the numbers of these slides so that you can follow his talk. Maybe, Jerry, if you would like to start, and maybe you give people a couple of, well, a little bit of time to download it.
Okay, thanks a lot, Frank. It's really great to have this opportunity for a computer-supported collaborative learning session on CSCL and on group cognition, my favorite topic. So if you turn to slide two, I'm going to start by summarizing a couple of the main claims of my paper entitled The Philosophy of Group Cognition. I assume that many of you or most of you have read this paper just recently, so I'll just read the summary claims from slide two as a way of refreshing and focusing your attention. Now, I'm happy that a number of you are interested in math education and other kind of practical applications of CSCL and group cognition. Today, I'm going to be on a rather theoretical level of discussion, I think. So you may not get many many practical findings about math education and so on. But I hope that this will help orient you to take this kind of approach to research in the future. So group cognition is really a theory of learning which focuses on the analysis of processes that take place at the small group unit of analysis. So it's really a focus on interactions rather than what takes place in people's heads. So a lot of research in the learning sciences focuses on what supposedly takes place in the heads of students or teachers or even in the heads of researchers. But group cognition is an attempt to get away from that and to focus on what takes place in the interactions that we can actually record and observe and analyze. So it provides a theoretical foundation for the learning sciences, especially in CSCL settings. And I'll get back to this towards the end of today's session, that how I view it as a foundational part of the learning sciences. In terms of research, a lot of studies in the learning sciences have always focused on individuals, and more recently, especially on larger communities. But there's been really very little analysis at the small group level, which is, to me, is the place that many of the most interesting processes of learning take place. And so group cognition is an attempt to focus on that under-researched area of the learning sciences. Furthermore, it's a method. It includes a method for analyzing the learning and analyzing it as it's taking place, not in terms of comparing pre and post tests and so on, but actually observing directly in the traces of interaction what's taking place, what the processes are that are central to group learning. And so it avoids having to hypothesize either mental or institutional entities like psychological or societal institutions. The virtual math teams project that Frank mentioned is an ongoing project. I've been working on it for about 12 years here at Drexel University. And I consider it a paradigmatic case of group cognition, and the studies there are, I think, models of analysis of group cognition in CSCL. So I formulated slide number 3 as a place to start our discussion and to have you think about some of the more controversial aspects of this theory of group cognition. So what I'd like you to do is read the two sections of this slide 3. And if you're in a room with other people from your institution, discuss it a little bit, and then type in the chat maybe a question from each of you or each group about these. I think these are probably the two most controversial aspects of the philosophy of group cognition, or the ones that are hardest for people to understand and accept. So the first one is that in the theory of group cognition, I propose that it's often fruitful to analyze cognition on multiple levels, in particular on the individual level, the small group, and the community level, as three levels of cognition that are often all three important to follow, and with different processes at these different levels. And therefore, the learning sciences need methods for analyzing cognitive processes at these different levels, not just one method for analyzing processes at a single level. The different levels require different methods, I think, of analysis. But the term group cognition is often misconstrued, it doesn't mean that there's some kind of group mind or anything like that at work. Nothing other than the interaction of the students in the group. It means that the analysis, it's about analysis, not about ontology, not about that there is this group mind or something, but rather that our way of analyzing cognitive achievements, especially those in CSCL settings, like the Virtual Math Teams project, may be most appropriately conducted at the group unit of analysis in terms of this interplay of people posting in chat and or on a drawing board and so on, as it's done in VMT, where things are shared by the group. So the focus is on actions and discourse that are shared within the group. And that's really the core of this philosophy of group cognition. So if you can type up some chat things, I'll give you a couple minutes to think about some questions you have about what this means or how it can be or whatever. And then I'll try, as I talk through the slides from the paper, to try to respond to some of your questions. So I'll just stop for a couple minutes and let you think about these topics and write something in the chat.
Just a technical thing, if you click on the chat tab directly on the word chat, then the window will be bigger. So if we now all type something into the chat, you might want to make use of that thing. And then if you press again or click again on chat, on this word chat in the tab, then it will be reduced again.
Okay, these are some great questions, and you can continue to type some. I think if you think about these questions and you hold them in your head or on your chat log, while I go through the three case studies from my paper, and think about how they apply there. Think about, for instance, Anna Svard's concept of thinking as communicating. How would that apply in these case studies? If you think about engagement, are the groups showing that they're engaged in these case studies, and so on? Can you see what the group knows and how they come to know it as a form of group cognition? Just like you would see what an individual knows and what they come to know as a form of individual cognition. So my first case study is summarized on slide 4. That data dates back to 2006, which is the first exciting mature data that we got in the VMT project. And it illustrates the analysis of discourse into adjacency pairs. In accordance with the finding of conversation analysis, that discourse is organized around such adjacency pairs. And for problem solving, I'm particularly interested in longer sequences of such pairs. And although the field of conversation analysis has been around for several decades and has analyzed enormous amounts of discourse in small groups, they generally analyze very short excerpts. And for analyzing something like learning mathematics, it's often necessary to look at longer segments, longer excerpts that include quite a number of these adjacency pairs. And so, just like Svard argued, to get at the thinking of people learning mathematics, say, we look at how they communicate about mathematics and how they how their discourse changes over time, so that their learning is reflected or is materialized a lot in the learning about the mathematical discourse. But here the example is two students, Wang and Asinks, engage in a long sequence of response pairs. In this case, I've shown 10 little discourse pairs or response pairs, where one person makes sort of a proposal and the other responds to it. So each utterance in there is either an interactional elicitation or a response, and the interaction is what creates the group as a cognitive agent. So just because there are two people chatting together doesn't mean there's an effective group. But when they start responding to each other in the way that Asinks and Wang did, and they had been chatting together with some other people for several hours over a period of weeks. So this wasn't, they hadn't just started an informal discussion. This had been an ongoing mathematical analysis that they had been working on. So I've given the 10 adjacency pairs titles, such as discourse moves, open the topic, decide to start working on it, pick an approach, identify the pattern that emerges, seek an equation to capture the pattern, negotiate what the solution is, check to see that it works in different cases. And then when they think they have the solution, celebrate the fact that they solved this problem, which in fact they had been working on for a number of hours and was a difficult problem. And then close the discussion. And if you think about it, this is pretty much what a more advanced mathematician or math student would do to solve a problem. They would typically go through individually. So mathematical individual cognition would follow this kind of problem-solving stages. And we see here that a small group follows the same kind of stages. So if we would say that an individual who conducted this problem-solving was engaging in cognition, then why not say that a group that does the same kind of thing as a group through their interaction at the group unit of analysis is also engaging in cognition. But here it's not individual cognition, so we call it group cognition. In the second case study on slide 5, this study I analyzed to show the importance of joint attention. Actually, I sort of discovered for myself how important joint attention was from doing this study. So there's a team of three students here, also middle school or high school students, named Jason Quirdiop and 137. And here in the chat that's excerpted up there, and by the way, on the next to the chat excerpt is a screen image of the virtual math team's screen, where you see an area for doing mathematical sketches or drawings and the chat stream, and you can point from the chat into an area of the drawing. So Quirdiop asks for a clarification of 137's proposal up there in the first line. 137 makes a proposal about what they should work on. Quirdiop asks for clarification. And then Jason, the third person, halts the further discussion until they can all see the same thing as a shared object of joint attention. So I think it's really nice the way that Jason says, wait, can someone highlight the hexagonal array on the diagram? I don't really see what you mean. So he wants to stop the discussion until he can see what the others see, what 137, who proposed this, sees in the diagram. He wants to see the diagram the same way that the others see it. And he recognizes that they can't have a real discussion until they all see the same thing the same way. And that's what I'm calling joint attention or co-attention. People in the group all have to be attending to the same thing and seeing it the same way, just visually, perceptually, in order to have that as the focus for their discussion. And we see that that 137 invents some ways of focusing everybody's attention on the same perceptual object, namely a certain triangle within a grid of triangles, which he says is a hexagon. So even in this diagram, which is from somewhat different place in the discussion, you can see there's some blue lines outlining a large hexagon in the grid. And then there's a triangle within that, because the hexagon has been divided with red lines into six different triangular shapes. And in each triangle, there's a series of lines that they're trying to count. And that's highlighted in the third way. So they're using different visual methods of aligning their perception to be the same. And then the third case study in slide six shows how shared understanding is established of a problem, namely of the group problem-solving path, of terminology, and of the group's conclusions. So these three students, who are three middle school girls, they coordinate very carefully their discussion to make sure that they're all on the same path or the same page, and they all have the same understanding. And that they all agree to the same conclusions. They can do the same constructions, each of them, once the group figures out how to do it, shares that understanding of each step and of the overall process. And so I picked these three case studies to show some of the important processes that take place at the group level. And I consider these cognitive processes, just as, like I say, if an individual did these kind of things, developed certain understandings, followed a certain path of problem solving, and so on, they would be considered cognitive processes. And psychologists would have special names for them, I'm sure. In this case, in these cases of the three case studies, the processes were conducted by groups, small groups of students working together. And it wasn't that one of them conducted the process and the others followed it, but that they the process was conducted through their interaction, through these adjacency pairs. So the responses of one person's utterance to another's, rather than through either utterance on its own. And so that's it studies like this that we've been doing of data from the Virtual Math Teams project, where we've tried to illustrate, or really to discover, the different kinds of processes that take place within groups working on something like school mathematics, geometry, for instance, or combinatorics. So typical middle school and high school math problems that students have to learn in using the virtual math teams, they learn it as groups. So the groups learn these, learn to do these mathematical problems. And then presumably or we can see that the individuals in the groups learn that as well. And so CSCL is premised on the idea that a good way to learn is through collaborative learning, through small group learning. And the studies of group cognition can document that actually takes place. So I think we can take a discussion break now, and I'll actually try to respond directly to some of your questions. So on slide 7, I've tried to suggest with a summary of the three case studies, how a group can constitute itself as an effective group and can constitute a world of shared meaning, such as a geometry problem of interest. So take a little time now in your groups to pose a question for discussion about this. And just type it in the chat, and I'll try to respond. Or you can pose it in the audio channel. That would be fine too. So here's my summary, starting from a kind of philosophical level, that the following the phenomenologists, who were German philosophers in the early 1900s, mainly, the ethnomethodologists, who were mainly active since the 1960s, showed that the shared social world is constituted continuously through group interaction. That's a lot of what ethnomethodology is about, showing this. How the social world is constituted. It's not just a given, but you can see how people in the society constitute it through their group interaction. We can study precisely how that's accomplished in collaborative learning situations. We see that it takes place over longer sequences of discourse moves, each centered on elicitation and response kind of adjacency pairs. Carrying out these longer sequences requires maintaining the three things that we saw in the different case studies: maintaining personal co-attention to a shared object, being there together at the object provides a shared focus for the discourse. Accompanying this, there must be a shared understanding of the object and of the discourse context, so that group members understand each other. So these are some of the kinds of group processes that constitute the group as a group and constitute their learning as a form of collaborative learning. So I'll stop now and let you pose some questions.
Jerry, can we invite also people to post video comments on that? So, because I think that the chat facility is for some people it's more complicated as they have only one keyword in the whole group. So maybe if we can have both as you suggested, that is great. And if we say like 5 minutes for preparing that.
Sure, that sounds great. That's why I stopped my broadcasting so that others could step in there.
Hi, Elaine at the University of Washington. Oh, there's the microphone. we were just discussing the nature of, especially thinking in a virtual environment, of how to ascertain or know what participants' prior relationships are. It seems like some of the data examples you showed to get to that level of comfort and discourse seems like it would require a prior relationship, either online or in real life. So just kind of curious if anyone has ideas about that, about if only online relationships facilitates better or facilitates learning versus working together in real time in physical space.
Yeah, that's a very important issue. So let me see. In the three case studies, in the first one, Asingst and Wang had been working with the third person for something like four sessions. This was their last session, I think, of a series of four sessions, each about an hour long. So they did not know each other outside of this series of sessions, but they did know each other from working on similar math problems like this for about 4 hours. And the same is true for the second case study, which was done actually at exactly the same time. It was another group working in 2006. So they also had a couple hours together, working together before this data was excerpted. And the third case study was done just less than a year ago. And I think this was their fifth hour together. And they didn't, this group of three middle school girls did know each other outside of class. But as far as I know, they didn't really discuss this problem outside of class. So there's a methodological issue that I prefer it when the students don't know each other outside of the VMT environment, because then as researchers, we know everything about what they know about each other, so that we can feel justified in interpreting, being as competent to interpret what they say to each other as they are, as participants. So since we understand the same language, English, and the same, we know at least as much about geometry, about the math domain as they do, and they don't have any prior relationships that they can draw upon or prior shared knowledge, we're in a pretty good analytic position. Whereas if students know each other and have certain ways of doing things and talking about them that they know and they can rely on in their discourse, but we're not aware of, then we're at a disadvantage analytically. And furthermore, if they speak outside of the session about what's going on in the session, then we don't have a complete record of the interaction. And that can be a real problem. We want to be able to say that we know everything that went into the solving of this problem by the group. Now, it may well be that individuals in the group did some work outside of the session that we don't know about. They may have looked things up on the internet, they may have talked to their parents, they may have written things on paper, and so on. And that's something that we don't know about, but the point is that neither do the other students in the group. So as far as analyzing the group processes of learning, we're only interested in what's shared within the group and in the interactions. And if we can capture pretty much a complete picture of that, then we're in much better shape. And that's difficult to do. It's taken years to figure out how to run these sessions and how to instrument the technology to capture everything that we need to have that complete a picture that we can really analyze how a whole problem is solved, that we have all the data that's necessary to do that at the group unit of analysis. Of course, we don't have it at the community level because we don't know what influences their schools have on what they've done, and we don't know it at the individual level because, as I say, we don't know the history of their individual training and what they might be doing offline as individuals. We don't know what's going on in their heads. But at the group unit, we can have a pretty complete picture. And that, to me, that's very important.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, when does group cognition start? Then when does it end? Because we are talking about individuals here, and then even in the group, there are some people who have some particular level of knowledge, and others who might just be participating somehow. So when does this thing about the group cognition start? When can we say that there is now group cognition, and when does it end?
And I also have a question, since we're interested in multi-level analysis of the individual, small group, and community level, to what extent would group and socially shared cognition would still be a group and socially shared cognition if we start looking at individual properties?
I wasn't clear about the second question. The first question, when does the group cognition begin and end? That's really up to the group. And part of the analyst's job is to see when the group starts acting and talking like a group. So if you look at slide 4, the first case study, their first discourse move is to open the topic. So Boang says, I think we are very close to solving the problem here. And Asinks responds, we can solve on that topic. Well, so here, even though Boang's statement begins with the individual pronoun I, it quickly switches to we. We're close to solving the problem here. And the implication is that he's proposing that this group, which is only the two of them at this point, but that they act as a we, as a group, and they take on the project as a group project of solving the problem. And that's how Asinks responds to the proposal, by saying basically, yes, we as a group can work on solving that topic. And so at that point, one of the things they're doing is picking a problem to work on. But in doing so, they're doing it as a group. They're saying, this is our group project. And so they're constituting themselves at that point in that discourse as a group, as an effective group. They're going to do something as a group. The group is going to have the agency of doing that cognitive work of solving that problem. And then at the end of that excerpt, you can see them wrapping up. And then the last thing is, we should keep in touch. Yeah. So that means we're going to stop being a group now. But as individuals, we should keep in touch and maybe get back together as a group at some point. But they're closing the fact that for now, they're no longer going to be effectively working as a group. So you can see in the discourse that they start becoming a group in the first line and they end becoming a group towards the end. So in conversation analysis, that's called opening and closings. And those are very important to conversation generally, and certainly to problem solving. They pick a problem, they work on it, they solve it or don't solve it or give up, whatever, and then they end their group work. So group cognition doesn't just mean that there's three bodies sitting in a room together. It means that something like this has taken place in the discourse where they've said, we're going to work as a group. This is what we're going to do. Let's get started now. Let's end now. So that's a very important thing for the analyst to do, is to say, when does it start?
Yeah, I just wanted to invite the second LMU speaker to maybe reformulate the question on multi-level analysis. And then there are three more questions, Jerry, in the chat by Phil, by Ben Yuan, and by Kai, and maybe we could address them as well before we proceed. So, but maybe if we let LMU formulate the second question again.
Maybe I was not clear with my question. So the question is, to what extent the collective unit of analysis, like the group, could be reducible to individual cognitive properties? And if so, are we still talking about socially shared cognition?
Yes, this is certainly a very common move, is to try to reduce the group to individuals. And the idea of group cognition is that this is not always a legitimate thing to do. That sometimes it's best to analyze at the group unit of analysis. And my argument partially has to do with the nature of these adjacency pairs, is that the meaning of what's being done in the discourse is being done through these adjacency pairs, not through individual utterances. So if you look at, if you analyze what's done, for instance, in the first case study on slide 4, 10, the analysis claims that 10 things are done, 10 steps of problem solving are taken. Each of these steps involves both of the individuals. If you just looked at Wang, he just doesn't accomplish anything. It's just not done by him alone. Nothing is done by him alone. It's done by the two of them together. Each step is done by the two of them together. Sometimes Wang starts and Azinx agrees to it, or doesn't agree or whatever, and other times it's the reverse order. So the accomplishment of solving the problem, the whole 10-step process, can't be really reduced. Now, of course, you can say that each step consists of two sub-steps, and each sub-step is done by an individual. So you can reduce it, of course. You can say that everything comes from one individual or another. But does the meaning and the process, is that really accomplished by one individual or the other? And I think the answer is that it's best to analyze these things as being done by, being accomplished by the group. And when you have two people, it's real easy to reduce it to individuals. When you have three or more, it becomes a lot more complicated. And because it's more complicated when there's three or four or more, then it makes it hard to analyze and to present clearly. And so in my effort to make a clear presentation, I chose this excerpt with only two people because it's very easy to follow what's going on. But it's also more tempting to try to reduce it to individuals. But I think surely neither one of these individuals would have gone through this process by themselves. If they had just been sitting there individually without talking to each other, even talking to each other, it took them hours to get to this point. They would surely have not gotten anywhere near this point and would have given up long ago if they hadn't been working as a group. So I'm not even sure what it would mean to reduce it to individuals. Would you say, well, let's take them out of the group and see if they accomplish the same thing? I'm sure that they would not accomplish the same thing because it's a combination of not only what each person puts into it, but also of the interaction. The interaction is really important. So most of these things, if you look at the content of the utterances, they're really a lot of them are just responses. They're not, it's not like you have in a rationalist philosophy view of two people where each one one of them solves the whole problem and then just express it. They solve it in their head using mental representations or whatever, and then they express it like what's in their head comes out in and can take in through their ears and then affect their mental images. Doesn't seem to be what's going on. It's more that they're responding to each other in the language. The language itself is one of responses. So they say things like just yes, or so that's wrong, or it actually is, or we did it, or yeah. So if you reduce it, then the whole point of the discussion sort of disappears. And the meaning that's created by the group is created sort of in between them in the interactions, not in the individuals' heads. Then they can understand it as individuals later, and they can regurgitate it later as individuals. But when it's happening, when the meaning is being created, it's being created in the interaction. And in that sense, you lose the whole point of the thing if you reduce it.
Okay, Jerry, before we move on, would you like to answer the questions? Or else, I think we can also come back to these later and move on a bit so that we also have the opportunity at the end to have a couple of general questions. I would also have quite a number of questions by now, but let's move on.
I think to some extent, I'm going to cover some of these other questions. So maybe we should move on, and then I'll talk for a few more minutes, and then we'll have the rest of the time for discussion. So let's see, if we go to slide 8, it does present a comparison and contrast of the three levels of the small group in one column, the individual, and the community. And it states that learning at the group level can be personalized at the individual level and institutionalized at the community level. So it's not that these levels are completely separate. And that's why, for instance, when we're tempted to reduce from one to the other, it's probably better to look at it both ways. You can see things going on at the group level, which are best analyzed as group processes, and other things which go on and are best analyzed at the individual level, and also influences and so on that are best analyzed at this social or community level. It's not that there are these are analytic stances, really. what's the best way to analyze what's going on? It's not that there's, that there are these individual human beings represented by their bodies and their heads, and that there are groups represented by sets of these individuals, and there are communities represented by large bodies of these communities. But it's more of an analytic approach to say that there's a lot going on in collaborative learning, and some of it is best analyzed in terms of what's going on psychologically, in terms of psychological parameters for individuals, what's going on and in within the personal history of trajectory, learning trajectory of those individuals, and so on. Other things that are best analyzed as group processes, and then some things that are best analyzed as social institutions or community practices, whatever you want to call it. So at the small group level, the group constitutes itself as an agent with projected tasks, situated needs and resources, and past accomplishments. And you can see that in the discourse. It's not something that you have to hypothesize, but you can actually see it, because in the discourse of the small group, people make those things explicit and available to each other. And they have to in order to collaborate. And since they have to make them available to each other, visible to each other, they also become visible to analysts who have a good record of the collaboration. And the small group enacts many group practices to achieve cognitive, linguistic, emotional group accomplishments. Now, a lot of these group processes have not yet been analyzed, so it's hard to say exactly what's going on. That's why we need to do more analysis at the group level. And then results of small group interaction may be transformed into individual skills at the individual level, skills, memories, etc. And they may also be institutionalized into community practices. And that ties into the other levels. At the individual level, the individual may adopt group practices through self-talk and reconstrue them in accordance with folk theories or individual psychology. So people aren't really aware necessarily of what they've experienced in participating in a group. They may reconstrue all of that in terms of their folk theories or in terms of their psychological theories or social theories, whatever. And so if you ask them for a self-report of what they've experienced using the survey, questionnaire, tests, focus groups, or interviews, what you get may be severely mediated their preconceptions as well as by their new role. So if the problem with testing people for collaborative learning is that if they learn things in a group and then you test them individually outside of that group, you're really not testing for what, the learning that took place was situated. And more we're seeing how important the situatedness of learning is. And then if you test them in an individual test situation, then you've destroyed the situation in which they learned it. And what they're going to give you back is very different from what they would have been able to give you in the original situation. And that's one of the main findings that Vygotsky made, is that people can do things in groups that they can't do outside of the groups. And he made the point, he distinguished the developmental level from the cognitive level of that you get when you test people outside of groups. So that presents a lot of methodological issues for the analysis of learning. If you want to evaluate collaborative learning, you better not evaluate it through tests of individuals, or at least be aware that you're going to get very different results. Of course, there is a role of the individual cognition in group cognition, because you have to have the ability of the individuals, participants, to understand and to respond to the interactions that are the core part of the group interaction. And then there's the community level. So if a small group develops some group practices, those group practices can, in certain instances, become established in as community practices. For instance, the group that Jason and QWERTY Op in 137 developed some group practices of coloring in lines in the hexagon array. If after their group session they went back to a classroom and demonstrated those things, those practices could be institutionalized in the classroom's practices, and eventually they could become part of high school textbooks and so on, and institutionalized in larger communities. And obviously, community practices flow the other way. So practices of mathematics, practices that, for instance, Euclid codified thousands of years ago, are still in effect and determine how small groups and individuals act when they do geometry. So all of these things are entangled in each other, and it's only a matter of separating them to help make the analysis easier or possible and clearer to present findings. But we also have to see how they're all intertwined, which is a task for the future of CSCL. And they have practical implications for things like MOOCs. So MOOCs are larger communities of people trying to learn, and they don't even include basic supports that are established for collaborative learning in small groups. So they become ineffective learning environments because they don't support social or collaborative aspects. They treat the students as individual learners, even though they're in a large group, and that's usually not very effective. So then on slide 9, we move to the methodological issues that some people were asking about in the question. And in this slide, I contrast my methodology for studying group cognition with a contrasting approach of statistical analysis, which is also popular in CSCL and the learning sciences. So if you look at articles in the CSCL journal, for instance, you see some that adopt the methodology of interaction analysis and some that adopt the statistical analysis approach. And then there are some mixed methods, which in some cases are the most interesting, which try to do some of both and in a coordinated way. But to contrast them, in this slide 9, I list for interaction analysis that, for instance, in VMT studies of interaction, the analysis can stay very close to the unmediated traces of the original interaction. Whereas in statistical analysis, the original data quickly becomes invisible. It's sorted into categories according to some coding scheme. And this requires interpretation and judgment by analysts who bring their own goals and preconceptions. Whereas in interaction analysis, for instance, the data that you saw was pretty close to, it was just excerpted from what originally appeared in the chat logs of the students themselves. So any details of misspellings and whatever was still in there. And it didn't have to be interpreted by the analyst, except to the extent that I picked out certain lines of the interaction or an excerpt from it. And the evidence that's presented in interaction analysis is the very details of the interaction without aggregation, imposed categories, or hypothesized mental constructs, etc. So one can see learning-related group practices taking place in the analyzed interaction. It takes some practice to notice them and to focus on these, but they are there, and a good analysis can be very convincing in bringing them out. The people who interact, the students who interact, demonstrate their understanding and learning visibly to the group and thereby to analysts. So just like I tried to show briefly the closing and opening, or the opening and closing of a topic in one of the case studies. These characteristics of the group processes are made visible in the discourse itself. People always ask about the generality of case studies, and the generality really comes from the fact that people use general practices. So if you can show a practice taking place in a case study in some detail and document how it's done, then it's probably something that's done by a lot of students. So it has some generality and interest. And at least you can show that in at least one case, this is what actually happened. Whereas in statistical analysis, you get things which claim to be more general, but they've averaged over the details so much and aggregated the data so much that a lot of the uniqueness of the specific actions has been just averaged over. And even if you get significant results, which is not always the case because of the averaging, it's not always clear why or how learning takes place, even if you can make a general claim about learning takes place under this condition versus some other condition. It doesn't necessarily why that's true or how that's true or what the limitations are on that, but, or the mechanisms, how that works. How do people do that? How do people learn under those conditions? It's not clear just because you have a statistical result about it. So that's most of what I wanted to talk about. I also have a final slide about the role of CSCL as the foundation of the learning sciences, but I think I'll leave that, and maybe Frank will urge me to get to that one. But slide 10 I try to argue that the importance of the analysis at multiple units of analysis, and how the question of how to relate them is really an open issue at this point. At a recent conference at CSCL 2013, last summer in Wisconsin, we had a workshop, and it tried to explore whether the different the different levels of analysis can be bridged through analysis of resources or interactional resources. And I think we just started. We're just starting to try to do that kind of analysis. So, for instance, in the VMT, it's pretty clear that the math problems that we give students are resources for their interaction that guide them very much, and they bring in content from the cultural traditions of mathematics and from school curriculum. So from the community level, they bring them in. And that stimulates recall at the individual level. And then it's the group interactions that play an important role in bringing these together, to organize the individual contributions as they unfold in the interaction and to achieve the goals called for by the community, institutions, and so on. So in this way, the group interaction plays a central role in the multi-level cognition, interpreting, enacting, and integrating elements from the other levels, producing a unified cognitive result and thereby providing a model for future community practice or individual skill. So that's one possible way of trying to link together the levels. So I guess the idea is that it's useful to analyze things at one level or another, and then to try to bring them back together and relate them, rather than trying, for instance, to reduce everything to one level. A reductionist program of the learning sciences, I think, would be outmoded, let's say. It's the kind of thing that positivism tried to do for the sciences more generally 100 years ago and failed, and that's why we've had cognitive theory and so on, critiquing behaviorism and positivism ever since. So I think it would be a mistake to try to reduce everything to one level. I think the important thing is to recognize that things are going on different levels, and the different levels are interrelated in important ways. So now I'd like to take questions and spend pretty much the rest of whatever time we have left to discuss those.
Okay, thanks, Jerry. And now I think my suggestion would be to make a quick round through all the sites and to hear some reactions, questions of all of the participants. I think that would be the right time. Please.
So hello, like we put in the chat, we would have the question how you would differentiate group cognition to situated learning, because we were discussing where the differences are and what the differences are.
Maybe we collect a couple of questions first or reactions. So if you just raise your hand or join the queue and then say what your local discussion is about and what your questions are. Maybe I can squeeze in with another question. So, Jerry, I wondered, it's a bit related to what Daniel just asked, the relation of group cognition and situated learning. So the concept of activity is not very central in your, I think it's central, but you do not often use the word. You use practices, I think. But if we assume that there is knowledge in activities, and then your participants come with a lot of knowledge on experiences in different culturally shared activities. And I wondered if it's not really crucial to focus on the fragments that they bring into the discussion rather than focusing so much on what they invent as a kind of new kinds of practices. So, because isn't it much more an assembly or a kind of recruiting of fragments of different practices applied to this new situation in a group, and rather than inventing the wheel totally new?
Well, I was waiting to see if other people wanted to put some questions on the queue, but let me address these from Munich. Yeah, so situated learning, obviously there are a lot of overlaps, but I think that if you take Levin Wenger's original book on situated learning, it focuses on the community level. It's all about communities of practice. So Levin Wenger's book is about the community level, I would say. If you look closely at their examples, a lot of the work of the community gets done in small groups. So one that comes to mind is the Taylors. So a lot of what Leif and Wenger are interested in is how a tailor moves from being an apprentice to a master within the large community of tailors within, I don't know, the country or the city, where there are a lot of tailor shops. But the actual work of apprenticeship gets done within an individual tailor shop, within the small group of tailors that are working together. And so I think to some extent, Wave was interested in the community level as an anthropologist. And so she focused on the community level of analysis and the processes that go on there. And she gave a brilliant presentation that really opened up the field in terms of looking at the processes of communities of practice. But therefore she ignored largely what was right in her data about the small group processes that went on within an individual tailor shop. And somebody else could take that data and analyze it at the small group unit of analysis and find out a number of different processes going on, especially learning processes, collaborative learning processes, which are distinct from the community processes that she focused on. Similarly, activity theory, I mean, obviously, there's also a lot of good things have come out of that. It's based direct lineage to Vygotsky. And I think Vygotsky is the foundational theorist for CSCL, as far as I'm concerned, and for group cognition, for that matter, specifically. activity theory is very important. And in particular, one thing that I've ignored until recently is the whole role of artifacts, which is a huge topic, central to CSCL, because our CSCL computer systems are artifacts. They can be analyzed in that way. And our learning environments are activity theories, which is a combination of people interacting using whole varieties of artifacts and so on, and different activities and different practices. And that's a great way to analyze things. But I think if you look at Engstrom's model and so on, his little triangle model and so on, it doesn't have a very sophisticated analysis of small groups. In fact, he argues against the focusing on small groups at all, that they don't exist because there's just networks and so on. But I mean, he has this theory of knots, that people form into knots of the network and then they dissolve, so there aren't permanent groups. Well, I don't claim that there are permanent groups either. The students in my data aren't permanent groups. They exist for a number of minutes or maybe hours. They come to be, they constitute themselves as a group, they focus on certain things, and then they say goodbye to each other and or stop acting as a group. That's certainly true. They're not permanent things, but they're still, while they work as a group, there are group processes that go on that you can't understand as at the level of the community, and you can't understand them at the level of the individual. They're distinct processes that, like I said, that that are closely related to individual and community processes, but distinct nevertheless and shouldn't be reduced to each other. So I think that's a failure of activity theory, or a shortcoming of it. Again, I think if you look at Engstrom's own studies or activity theory studies, CSCW studies and so on, you see that a lot of the work is done in small groups of people interacting. But the focus of those studies is often to analyze what's going on at community level. But I'll stop.
Oh, sorry, I didn't want to interrupt. Jerry, you were not done with your sentence.
No problem. Go on.
No, it was interesting listening to you talking about the shortcomings of activity theory. I think we, in the remaining 10 minutes, we should also have a final round where everyone says something, what he takes from that session. But let me first ask two questions that we ask more or less all of our speakers. So the one is, what is your recommendation to PhD students and maybe also the master students that are here with respect to how to focus their work? Because I think especially with respect to group cognition, if you address learning, the analysis of learning on a small group level, and you go there with this kind of complexity that might easily overwhelm a PhD student. So is it reasonable to focus on one of the levels, say focus on individual thinking and the different influences on the different levels? Or is it only possible to study group cognition in that level of complexity? So what is your recommendation there? And then the second question is what you already expected, the relation of group cognition specifically, but more generally CSCL and the learning sciences. So what are the relations, relationship from your perspective of computer-supported collaborative learning? What role does it play in the learning sciences? And maybe you can also quickly say a couple of words on the International Journal of the Learning, in the International Journal of Computer-Supported Collaborative Learning. Sorry.
Okay, first advice for graduate students. I don't see why thinking, analyzing group cognition is any more difficult than analyzing any other level. I think it may be harder to automate. So a lot of analysis these days of the community level is done by pulling down a lot of data on some social networking website and doing an automated analysis of social networking or something. You can't really do that at the small group level. It doesn't really make sense. But if you're interested in doing case studies of discourse, that's all that's needed. You just take some data where it seems like something interesting is going on, and you try to look carefully at just what's going on. How are the participants there accomplishing what they're doing? How's the group getting done whatever task it sets itself to do? And you're likely to find something interesting. I think there's kind of a rule in research, maybe an unstated rule, that in a new field, it's easy to find to make big discoveries. So if you take a new approach where not many people have gone before, like focusing on small group processes, then you're likely to find pretty quickly, as you scratch below the surface, you're likely to find some processes that people haven't discussed before. Whereas if you use a more traditional analysis and more traditional kind of experimental setup, then you're likely to find the same things that everyone else has found over the past 20 years. And when your articles come to review, people are going to say, well, what's really new here? Because everybody knows how things operate in terms of, you know, a cognitive load or whatever. So I would recommend that you go into the field of group cognition, because that's where not much is known, not much has been analyzed so far. And in particular, also think about how the different levels do interrelate. Figure out a way of collecting some good data that shows the interrelationship, shows some things moving from collaborative learning in groups into, and document how it affects individual learning and document how it affects community learning and vice versa. That's a little more challenging perhaps, but even less researched, even less understood. I think, you want to be researchers of the future. You don't want to just be researching the same things that people have researched in previous generations of researchers. So that would be my advice if you're still looking for a topic. Let's see. Foundational. So I do view CSCL as something that should be a foundation for the learning sciences. And so slide 11, I tried to outline this. And as I said, I take Vygotsky as the starting point. So he argued that all higher human mental or psychological functions originate in interpersonal small group interactions. That's his main claim, and he spent his short career documenting that with psychological experiments and so on. And if you think about that sentence, basically it says that that group cognition is the foundation of the learning sciences, that learning is founded in the kind of learning that takes place in interactions among people, small groups of people, for instance, in the family. And he was talking largely, a lot of his experiments had to do with young children who were just developing the different psychological facilities. But I think it goes for anybody. I mean, even at my age, I learned most of what I learned. The new things anyway, I learned from interactions with other people, like this video conference probably will provoke some things for me that will lead to further learning. And then this whole idea of individuals as being foundation, I think is just wrongheaded. And philosophers like George Herbert Mead showed that individual identity is adopted from how people view each other. So you start from people interacting and viewing each other and understanding the identity of other people and of the we, the other, as more fundamental than I. And the I then is a later version turned inwards of what other people, how other people see, probably see me. That's my identity. so that the it's the interactional things that are primary. And you know, like somebody mentioned on the Schwartz theory, that think all thinking is communicating, and individual silent thinking, just like Vygotsky said, it's an internalization of self-talk, talking to oneself, which is learned from talking to other people. So language is a social phenomenon. It's not something that you were born knowing inside your head. It's something you learned from, not only from interacting with other people, but in order to interact with other people. And then you internalize that, to use Vygotsky's term. So, so that, and, you know, and I've been trying to discover some of the group processes that are fundamental to learning and that support learning at all levels, but that take place, at the small group level. And CSCL is an attempt in the computer age to support collaborative learning, to support people's learning together. And situated learning, Leven-Wenger and so on, also showed that learning, the foundation of learning is not the individual, but in their case, they put the emphasis on larger communities of practice. And I put some of the emphasis on the smaller groups, but it's not that, but in both cases, it's the individual is kind of a secondary byproduct of those things. So that's how I see it. Yeah, and I think the learning sciences historically has come out of disciplines like psychology and education, which put the emphasis on the individual. And I think then maybe the emphasis should be on all three, on the individual, on small groups, and on communities, but not just on the individual as foundational. So maybe we need multi-methodologies and multi-foundations. And then to think about how they work together, but not by reducing one, by reducing all of them to just one of them. So that's basically my view, I guess.
Okay, Jerry, thank you. I think we are very close to the end. Actually, we are 15 minutes already over time, but we started late. Let me thank you very much, Jerry. I think we will have a minute left for others to react, say bye-bye, or whatever they like to say, and then maybe you have the final words. But first, let me thank you for a very interesting session where we also saw and experienced how deep one can really go into the data and analyze cognition on the group level. I think that was a very good model, and I'm happy that we have the recording of that as well, that we can use it later on in our own teaching as well, and stimulate more discussions on that topic that deserves much more time to be discussed. So, Jerry, thank you very much for your presentation, guiding us through that discussion. Also, all the other participants, thank you for joining, for putting in your questions, comments, and contributions. Okay, and maybe if you just have a quick reaction at the end, and then Jerry, if you like to have the final words. Bye-bye.
Let's wave. Hi, Jerry. Thank you very much from the LMU. We had some great discussions here, and we still have so many open questions, so that the seminar could go on for hours if it weren't like 10 p.m. and all of us are quite tired. We hope you will be here in Munich at some point, and we can ask you these questions. Thank you very much. Well, have a nice day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, thanks for the invitation to Munich. I will take that seriously. I hope that some of you will think about the group cognition perspective and approach to analysis of learning. And I'd like to thank you all for joining us, and especially Frank, for for putting this together. It's been a great opportunity. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.